My name is Rick Cheddar, and this is From Radioland. I'm often asked from time to time, all that seems sort of redundant, but I am asked every once in a while, what got me into the business of radio? And, you know, From Radioland here, this podcast has been devoted, you know, fairly exclusively so far to the business of broadcasting, the business of radio through my eyes, through the years that I have devoted to it over time. And it has been a wild trip, and the genesis of which you can find more on from the very first episode of this podcast. Just go to wherever it is that you find it, look for episode one. That was Jeff Janovitz and I having a chat. And this particular edition, I wanted to have a, you know, I know that for those who have been subscribers, first of all, thank you very much. We hope you continue to listen to this program as we build an audience, and the audience is growing like crazy. And thank you so very much for all of your support. The idea here, though, to get away from some of the more morose end of it, because I'm asked, not only am I, you know, why I got into the business, but if I'm ever going to write a book, and I don't know that I'm ever going to sit down and just write something. That's as fun as that might be, as cathartic as that might be, there is an enormous amount of time and energy that can go into something like that. And there are a million ways to go about publishing it. I mean, you've got, of course, the whole ebook thing. You can go the hard copy route. You can find a publisher. There's just a million ways, much like the way the radio industry has changed over the years into the technology that is the internet. The same thing can happen with the written word. And as much fun as that might be, I'm thinking this whole podcast here is going to be sort of a long form audio book delivered to you by the guy who would write it, which would be me. Having said all of that, I don't know that I would really want to go that far. And I guess it's a lot easier for me to just sit here and speak about this sort of thing. And the reason being, like with this particular this show, this episode, if you will, I wanted to do things a little bit differently here and kind of give you a peek into why I got into the business. As mentioned before, you know, in the first episode, Jeff and I talked at length about, you know, the whole little box of magic. Now, history will tell you that Guglielmo Marconi developed it. Okay, yeah, he developed part of it. Let's be honest here. I'm one of the people that come to the school of Nikola Tesla that really kind of turned, you know, a lot of the parts together. You know, he was, of course, a Serbian engineer. A lot of people do consider what he did the genesis of traditional broadcast that we would, you know, that we would think of. And when you look into the history of how all of this worked, you know, there came the whole deal of figuring out that there was an invisible spectrum that was all around us, and it could be used. It could be dealt with. You can't hold it in your hand. You can't really see it, but not without special equipment. And you can't necessarily, you know, do much with it except put things on it and have it interpreted over a distance, and then reimagine, you know, to the sound that you hear. You know, obviously it changes, and that's why, you know, over the years people have said to me, well, Radio Memphis is not really radio, you're just on the internet, so it just isn't radio. Well, you know, look, about 75-80% of our audience digest Radio Memphis through their mobile devices, which are connected via radio waves to your device. So technically, yes, it is radio. In fact, your mobile phone has several radios that are built into it, believe it or not. That's just how the thing works. If you're connected to a network that you can make calls on, you're on typically a 3G or 4G LTE type system. There is another thing called the Edge, which is another, it's a lower form of communication, but it does make the phone work, and you can, you know, receive and transmit vocal sounds through the airwaves, hence the completion of a telephone call. What sets the internet and the invisible waves that the phone uses is that you are on a subscribed airwave deal. You have to pay for that. And as a result of that, and this does get kind of crazy, but the Communications Act of 1934 kind of designated the free airwaves, and the FCC overrides a lot of that. They oversee that kind of thing. So therefore, the FCC doesn't control anything that Radio Memphis does. Pardon me. So as a result, yeah, we are on the radio. Now, there's another form of radio that is inside your phone, and that would be your Wi-Fi, which allows you to connect to another network that connects you to the internet, and it's wireless, and there you go. And then there's a third form that is on your phone that is called Bluetooth, which is a much more shorter distance type thing. Usually runs about 40, 50 feet if you're lucky. It's a thing you put in your head and you're in your ear, and you can listen to telephone calls. You can make calls through that device as well. And I have one of these coolest things my friend Jeff does have, which is a stereo Bluetooth thing that he wears, and so he can listen to Radio Memphis or whatever it is that he's listening to in stereo, and he can make phone calls, and it's in his head, and off he goes. It's way cool. So yes, being broadcasting on the internet, yes, technically it is radio. So the application of older technology into new technology was sort of the genesis of the radio station, and hence why we do what we do. Now, having laid all that out for you, there are some things that you have to consider. In my years of being a broadcaster, I was always attracted to what this magic thing can do. All right. Now, granted, Nikola Tesla he created the whole idea of, using this type of stuff and putting it together. But it actually goes a little bit further behind him as well. A guy by the name of Heinrich Rudolf Hertz in 1888, he was able to prove that transmitted airborne electromagnetic waves in an experiment confirmed various theories of electromagnetism. Now, after the discovery of what were called Hertzian waves, this coming from our friends over at Wikipedia, so take this for a grain of salt, but although this is fairly accurate, it would take 20 years for the term radio to be universally adopted for this type of electromagnetic radiation. So, enter Tesla, who's like, well, we can do all sorts of stuff. He considered the waves relatively useless for communication since light could not transmit further than line of sight, according to those theories. Well, in 1892, a physicist by the name of William Crookes wrote on the possibilities of wireless telegraphy based on Hertzian waves. And in 1893, Tesla proposed a system for transmitting intelligence and wireless power using the Earth as a medium in and of itself. Well, in 1894 came Guglielmo Marconi, the Italian inventor. There was a great book called Marconi and the Magic Box, and I recommend it if you can get your hands on it. It tells a wonderful story about how he married into the Irish whiskey fame of, I believe it was Bushmills, and used whiskey money to fund his experiments in successful wireless telegraphy, and he was the first one to build a complete commercially successful system based on the Hertzian waves. He also demonstrated application of radio in military and marine communications and started a company for the development and propagation of radio communication services and equipment. He was a bit of a visionary. He met a lot of obstacles along the way, to the point that in Ireland, he set up the first transmitter and had his buddies over in Newfoundland listening on a receiver, waiting for him to blast across the Atlantic some radio signal, which ultimately he succeeded in. And what was amusing about it were the people that lived in the small village where the transmitter was set up in Ireland. They would complain about the blasts of electricity flying off of the antenna, which was this enormous array that sat there on the hill overlooking the Atlantic Ocean. And they were saying, well, what's he trying to do? So he was trying to transmit an electrical signal across the Atlantic Ocean to North America. And they said, well, there's no point in having a receiver because the thing is so damn loud, we can hear it perfectly clear from right where we are. Of course, they were all at the foot of this transmitter, so, there you have it. But nevertheless, successful radio transmission did occur through Marconi, and in a way it went. Now, it was obviously so successful that the Marconi Wireless Company was built, and there was Marconi Wireless Europe and Marconi Wireless England and Ireland, and he'd stick Marconi Wireless in front of everything, including North America and Canada or U.S. and Central and South America. So So, yeah, the wireless system obviously became the only real true method at the time to get things done. It became so successful that once it was all refined and done correctly, that a lot of ships really relied on the system for sending messages from ship to shore and vice versa. It was so important at the time that it even superseded this really wild idea that you could do a vocal transmission, which is, what, of course, what Radiohead turned into. Reginald Fessenden is the man who really kind of got into all of that, but that wasn't, you know, involved until amplitude modulated radio, AM radio, amplitude modulation. He was actually the first to really kind of put vocal sounds on the air, and he did so around the early part of 1900, around 1906, and I believe it happened on Christmas Eve. I say that because ships at sea on his broadcast heard his first that included him playing O Holy Night on a violin and reading a passage from the Bible. Nevertheless, vocal work didn't really, you know, play that big of a part of broadcast until, you know, much later down the road, because for some reason Morse code became a thing that it was easily adapted to line transmission, where you had, you know, down the railroad lines in the last days of the Old West, they would send signals up and down the rail tracks or actually on lines, and it was the on and off of the click, and you knew how to decipher those sounds, and thus became Morse code. As a matter of fact, there was a couple of guys that had really taken some fascination into the old form of Morse code. So I've got a little audio I want to play for you here. Imagine that. I've actually sort of prepped this thing, even though it doesn't sound like it. So on April 15th, 1912, pop quiz, what happened? April 15th, 1912, what happened? The Titanic sank. And when it did, it was going through quite a mess. They were receiving tons of reports prior to being struck by or striking an iceberg. They were receiving and sending out messages to Newfoundland and elsewhere around the Atlantic from the passengers that were on board the Titanic. And ultimately, the captain of the ship, Smith, I believe is his name, came rolling into the communications room, the wireless room, and told the radio operator, who was the communications guy, his actual real title was wireless telegraphist. That was his job, and it was all put forth by the Marconi Company. A cat by the name of Jack Phillips, and he sent out a message stating that they had struck an iceberg and the Titanic was sinking. And he gave their position in latitude and longitude and was requesting help, to the point of sending the true SOS. And, of course, that was never really recorded. But we do have a guy to thank for this. A cat by the name of David Ring found a way to capture what it would have sounded like. We don't know who the telegrapher is, but this is what it would have sounded like had you been on board one of the ships that had just heard that there was something going on, and this message came blasting through your speaker. That's how news traveled from one spot to another in those days. Those clicks, those dashes, those dots, translated correctly, will give you a complete message. There's a lot of shorthand in there. You can go online and find the actual message out there by, you know, just searching what that message actually was. And also, basically what it says was that they had struck an iceberg. They were beginning to sink. That noise was too loud because of steam escaping. So You know, they constantly sent that message out over and over, and in hopes that somebody would find them. And obviously, a couple of ships did, and everybody knows the story from there. So there you go. That's the basics of the business. That little moment to hear that sound is really quite magical to me, because this was where people could communicate over distances. In a, you know, what seems sort of primitive and somewhat clumsy way, but it was very effective, and it did a wonderful thing. Now, onward, we go into history. Here's another little thing for you, a little quiz here. Tell me what happened on May 6th, 1937. You don't have to tell me. Speak it out loud, or, you know, or say it to yourself, because if you get it right, you're actually pretty smart. May 6th, 1937. I'll give you another clue. The voice you're going to hear is Herb Morrison. Herb Morrison died in 1989. But on May 6, 1937, he was an employee of WLS in Chicago. He had been sent to New Jersey for the landing of the Hindenburg. Yeah, he's that guy, and gave this account of what happened.
It's starting to rain again. The rain had cracked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from...
It bursts into flames. Get it started. It's rising terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between it. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's 500 feet into the sky, and it's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the flame is rising to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the furniture is speeding around it. I don't do it. I can't even talk to people. There's friends around there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honestly, it just laid down massive smoking wreckage. And everybody can't hardly breathe and talk and screaming. Lady, I'm sorry. Honestly, I can hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside while I cannot see it. Charlie, that's terrible. Listen, folks, I'm going to have to stop for a minute because I've lost the voice. This is the worst thing I've ever witnessed.
What's remarkable about that broadcast was that's really one of the first times that a recorded story was played back live on the air. Up until this point, actually up until about the early stages of World War II, everything that was heard on radio was a live broadcast. Well, at the time, there wasn't, you know, a way to really, I guess, technically broadcast at the time something of importance like the Hindenburg exploding, because it was just an airship that was coming from Europe and it was docking there here in the United States. And there were, you know, some people on board, 36 of which I believe died. One of them was somebody on the ground, one of the guys that was capturing the ropes. But his rendition of what had occurred there, I mean, you hear him discussing this in detail, and obviously you hear him lose his mind. He's witnessing something that's really quite fascinating to him. The famous line, "Oh, the humanity." And he begins weeping openly. Now, this is an interesting point of history, because up until this point, people that were on the air, they've been told, and they still hold to this, that they are told to withhold emotion or bias in any story. Now, I know bias, you know, nowadays you've got all sorts of biased media out there. But back in those days, when you had such a limited form of what broadcast was, you had to kind of suck it up and deal with it. Well, the story has it that old Herb Morrison there, wound up losing his job over this. I don't know how true that really is, but I can see why that would be, because carrying on some type of professionalism while broadcasting would be a big thing. Now, that recording, that aired the way you just heard it, unedited. He had an engineer with him by the name of Charlie Newham. Anyway, you hear him talking about Charlie at the beginning of it. And what he's saying is, "Charlie, I hope you're getting this," because Charlie was there running this recorder, and it recorded on this kind of a, almost like a record player, like a disc type deal. And right after the incident, those discs were flown back to WLS in Chicago from New Jersey and played over the air. pretty important stuff. Think about this, though, as we move on. 3 years later, in 1940, August 24th, 1940, one of the most famous broadcasts in radio history occurred from one of the smoothest guys out there. Now, this is the thing. The contrast between Herb Morrison and what this gentleman did was absolutely remarkable. And this is the standard by which broadcasters for many, many, many years would hold themselves to. This is Edward R. Murrow.
This is Trafalgar Square. The noise that you hear at the moment is the sound of the air raid sirens. I'm standing here just on the steps of St. Martin's in the Fields. A searchlight just burst into action off in the distance, one single beam sweeping the sky above me now. People are walking along quite quietly. We're just at the entrance of an air raid shelter here, and I must move this cable over just a bit so people can walk in. There's another searchlight just square behind Nelson's statue. Here comes one of those big red buses around the corner. Double-deckers they are, just a few lights on the top deck. In this blackness, it looks very much like a ship that's passing in the night, and you just see the portholes.
He's, of course, describing the bombing of London in 1940 from the Germans in the early days of the Second World War. Well, you know, that was a pretty big deal, and that was live. At the time, I believe he was with United Press International, and then later it was also picked up by CBS. And, of course, Ed Murrow had been around for a long, long time before then and had a wonderful career into CBS long after he left the radio business into television in the 50s and 60s. Now, the thing about Ed, there is a very prestigious journalism award called the Murrow Award, the Edward R. Murrow Award, and it honors journalistic integrity through television, which I think is odd in a way because Ed was a radio guy first and foremost. Now, he once said, and I'm going to paraphrase here because I don't have the actual speech in front of me, but he makes a description of what television was, and he said something to the effect, and this is what's written on the award, that it can inspire, it can educate, and it can move people to great lengths. But without intelligence of some sort, television is nothing more than a box of lights and wires. And, I, you know, up there with what Newton Minow had said about television being a vast wasteland, I think those two guys pretty much nailed TV, I think, for the rest of the rest of humanity. So, anyway, there you go. That was in 1940. All right, so shortly thereafter, in 1941, America got dragged into the Second World War. December 7th, of course, Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Now, if you think I'm going to tell you, I'm going to play for you the Franklin Delano Roosevelt audio, you're sadly mistaken. And of course, it's a very famous speech that he actually, it was a joint session of Congress that President Roosevelt had ordered, and he discussed openly the attack on Pearl Harbor. That speech occurred actually on December 8th, the next day. And it was broadcast. But this is what actually, what's really cool here is that there was a reporter outside of KTU in Honolulu, Hawaii, right there witnessing this on the roof, and he's going to describe it. Now, this is what happens here. And this, I don't know that many people are familiar with this particular piece of history, but this is absolutely fascinating to me. This guy had the foresight on the island of I guess it was, is it Pearl Harbor on the main island, Honolulu on the main island? Anyway, he calls. He actually picks up a phone, and this is in 1941, mind you. He gets in contact with an operator while the United States is under attack, and he somehow miraculously gets connected with the National Broadcasting Company in New York City. NBC Radio picked up this telephone conversation, which is kind of cool because right at the end of it, the operator that connected him is trying to get him off the line. Check this out.
Call NBC. This is KTU in Honolulu, Hawaii. I am speaking from the roof of the Advertising Company Company. We have witnessed this morning the distant view. Off Pearl Harbor and a severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by every nearly 3 hours. One of the bombs dropped within 50 feet of KTU Tower. It is no joke, it is a real war. The public of Honolulu have been advised to keep in their homes and await results from the Army and Navy. There has been fierce fighting going on in the air and on the sea. The heavy shooting seems to be We cannot estimate yet how much damage has been done, but it has been a very severe attack. The Navy and Army appear now to have the air and the sea under control.
That was actually picked up and broadcast across the world. That was really what I guess one of the earlier forms of true live breaking news, where telephone became an integral part of what radio was happening. I'm sure there have been other incidents, but keep in mind, you know, in 1941, when the United States is all of a sudden dragged into this horrible war by the Japanese and the attack thereof in Pearl Harbor and the massive casualty lists and this thing. And I find it also amusing that he states in there, this is not a joke. It's very, very interesting stuff. All right, so now you got the way the news is being brought to you. And during the time, you know, of the 40s, the 30s and 40s, radio was it. I mean, television really didn't make the scene for, you know, quite some time. But when you had the idea that everybody would gather around the radio in your home, the radio at that point, of course, was a piece of furniture. And I know there's a lot of folks that are listening to this going, well, duh, this is all, you know, this is history. You know, we all know these stories. Keep in mind, there's a generation amongst us right now who don't understand that this actually occurred. They don't know what it sounds like to actually tune manually between stations and hear the dead gaps and the static and they don't quite get that, because that's all been left behind. Kind of sad. But, you know, you had theater, of course, you know, the Lone Ranger was happening at that time on the radio. You had your soap operas, where shows like Guiding Light, Days of Our Lives, those shows actually had their genesis in radio, were hugely popular. As a point of trivia, soap operas were called soap operas because soap manufacturers were the primary advertisers on those shows. Brought to you by Procter & Gamble and the makers of Dove. Oh, yeah. And then, you know, you had your news, you had music, and the music then, too, not necessarily, there was some probably very light version of it would be recorded for playback later, but a lot of it was live, and it was like from, you know, the such and such ballroom in New York, and you're going to hear the New York Philharmonic Orchestra performing Swan Lake, or, you know, that sort of thing. And you had game shows that were very popular on the radio, and people just, that's where they got their lives, between the radio and the newspaper industry. In fact, there was a big battle between the two mediums. The newspaper industry thought that radio was just, you know, who are these kids think they are? Everybody's going to love to sit down and read a newspaper. So therefore, their advertisers were going to get more bang for their buck in a newspaper article than hearing somebody talk about their products over the radio. Well, we all know how that turned out. Ultimately, part of the Great Depression in 1931 was sparked a little bit by what radio was doing. There was a bit of a panic by advertisers, and so all of a sudden agencies were starting to pull their business away from newspapers, and they were pulling some of their business away from radio at the same time, even though radio was trying to chip away at it and make a few bucks. It did help create more of a panic at the stock exchange than people probably give credit to. And as a result of that, it was just sort of downhill from there. And of course, the whole bank thing. And then, you know, you can go on your history with that. But by the early 1950s, you know, AM radio was the thing. Everybody had it. It was solid. It was a piece of your life. FM radio, of course, wouldn't really make the scene for quite some time. The reason being was that the gentleman that got into it, that actually sort of developed it, was Edwin Howard Armstrong. We'll get into a little bit more about him in a moment, because we'll go ahead and do it now, because Ed figured out of a way of using FM. Now we spoke of AM as being amplitude modulation. FM is frequency modulation. It's at a higher rate of frequencies, thus giving a greater bit of quality. What you would consider on an AM, what they would call monooral or single channel, gave way to FM, which is biaural, which is two channel. In two channel, you could do two things. You could set two mono signals that wouldn't interfere with each other, or combine the two and have FM stereo. Well, that's where music was going to really move to, and that became a big deal. Now, that goes on and on, because Ed Armstrong, when he created FM radio, he developed it primarily for using as a way for the military and the government to use it for long-distance relay communications for the government and for the military. And it didn't really go well, and to make a very long story short, Edwin Armstrong ultimately wound up committing suicide by leaping to his death as a result of all of this, because of the legal fight that had taken place, and that the FCC wasn't going to get involved with it. And this guy, you know, Armstrong had sunk so much money into the whole thing, and ultimately it just didn't, you know, it didn't work out in his favor at that time. So, you know, he had put his family into debt, and his poor wife and children and all of that. Well, it was just, you know, just sad all the way around. Now, obviously, FM eventually took off shortly thereafter, and he got to see a little bit of that, but not much of it. I mean, the real success of FM radio didn't come till long after his passing. But still, AM radio had quite the stranglehold on music and the broadcast of music, and of course, the early days of rock and roll. Check this out from Memphis, Tennessee. The birthplace of rock and roll, Ground Zero, WHBQ. Dewey Phillips, The Red Hot and Blues Show. This is kind of cool, because I'll tell you a little bit something about this clip here from 1952 right after it.
Oh,
write me a letter.
Oh, yes, sir. Good to see you, so Phillips. I don't want to buy it. Got Kennedy Veterans Hospital in Ward 24E. Just flat fixing, bringing you the hottest thing in the country, Real Hot and Blue, coming to you through WHBQ in Memphis, Tennessee, and it's Friday night, tomorrow's payday and bath day. That's a good deal. Yes, sir, the first 15 minutes of Real Hot and Blue is coming to you through the courtesy of the best beer that money can buy. We're talking about CV for me and CV for you. That champagne velvet distributed by the Mass Security Company right here in the city of Memphis. Now, don't forget, by now, let's just flat wake up out there. Let's get ready. We're going to start off the first record here. Let's see now. Wait a minute here. We're going to play the first record for, let's see, for Demi, for Perry, for JV, for Bernice, for Vera, and for Beulah, for Effie, for Oliver, for Santa May. Going to play it for Bulldog. And the title is, we're going to Flat Dig the Boogie by Piano Red. Let's go, man. Start off Red Hot and Blue. Don't forget, good PB, you can't buy a better beer than good old CV beer. When you go to the baseball game, you know it just ain't no baseball game unless you got a good old cold bottle of CV in your hand, or maybe a case on the left side. Now, that CV beer is flat good. I'm telling you, when you go to your favorite tavern or just any old joint, always order CV Champagne Velvet, the beer with the million-dollar flavor. Don't forget, when you're sitting around home playing canasta, or I could say something else, and listen to Red Hot and Blue, always have CV. Just go back in the Frigidaire, and if your old lady's got a cram full of ham and eggs and all that, just pull them out and lay them on the floor and put that CV in there and get it cold, and always serve your friends CV, the beer with that new 1952 taste. You ought to taste that taste. The beer that is lighter and buying it better and drier. So don't forget to get CV. I always say CV for me and CV for Phillips. That's a good deal.
Dewey was in a hospital bed at the time. He was recovering from a car accident and was able to broadcast there. And some of the pictures there are quite amusing. Him laying in the bed, and they actually had this this big microphone that had that they'd somehow put on a tabletop type stand, and it was on his bed. And then sitting next to him was a cat actually jocking the show. You know, having the turntables and a small board, and they were able to broadcast from there. But there you go, the Red Hot and Blue Show. All right, now, rock and roll comes onto the scene about 55, 56. Ooh, it's a big deal. The term rock and roll, who came up with it? Trivia, hello? Alan Freed. Where? Cleveland, Ohio. okay, maybe that's why the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is in Cleveland. I just because of Alan Freed. I don't know that I buy all that. WJW in Cleveland, 1957. Here's a little clip from Alan Freed.
Hello, everybody. How are y'all tonight? This is Alan Freed, the old king of the Moondoggers, and it's time again for another of your favorite rock and roll sessions, Blues and Rhythm Records, for all the gang in the Moondog Kingdom, from the Midwest to the East Coast. We're going to be saying hello to a lot of folks who've written to us tonight from all over the Moondog Kingdom, all around the Cleveland area, Newark, New Jersey, New York City, Long Island, wherever you are. And I hope you folks have a good supply of good old Aaron Brew on hand. It's the greatest beer of them all, Northern Ohio's largest selling beer, and it's perfectly balanced for good taste and flavor. So enjoy Aaron Brew as you enjoy the Moondog Show.
So as we progress forward through time into the 1960s, we go. FM radio by this point was becoming more of a real, viable opportunity for broadcasting music, and it was continuous. There was some news, not much. The FM model is what we follow at Radio Memphis. Radio Memphis was based off of the whole idea of what the Pirates were putting out in England at the time. A wonderful movie, Pirate Radio, is just an absolutely wonderful film, and it's Philip Seymour Hoffman is in the film, and some various other actors. If you get a chance to catch it, it's good. It didn't do well critically or at the box office, but for those of us that are in the business, it is kind of a fun look at how the radio business really kind of translated throughout the years. But in short, there was a ship. Well, there were actually several, but there was a ship, Radio Caroline being one of them, that would set anchor just outside of the international border on the Atlantic Ocean of Great Britain, and it would broadcast popular music into Great Britain because the BBC at the time, which controlled all of the media, was a government-run operation, controlled all of the media that was being broadcast to the people of Great Britain. Well, they weren't getting into popular music, and I guess they just felt that it wasn't nice to play it. And, well, at any rate, Radio Caroline came along as one of the others, Radio Caroline and Radio London, and they took off with their broadcasts and really exposed rock and roll and popular music to the masses by way of getting around what the government was trying to control at the time. Once again, another fascinating story, but here's what it kind of sounded like. This is a little sample of their imaging from Radio Caroline and another outfit called Radio London. Take a listen to this.
You're tuned to Radio Caroline on 199, home of the good guys. It's now exactly 8 o'clock, Bulova watch time. BULOVA, Bulova, the world's largest makers of quality Swiss watches.
Caroline, the sound of the nation. Caroline, the sound of the land. Caroline, the sound of the nation.
Tune to Radio Caroline on 199, your all-day music station.
Going back in time on the sounds of the nation, it's a Caroline flashback.
This is wonderful Radio London, where you're hearing things,
where you're hearing things.
These crazy, wacky pirate broadcasters, that's the way it goes. And that's the spirit behind Radio Memphis, and let me explain by that. Well, first of all, the company that actually owns Radio Memphis is called Pirate Radio Studios Incorporated, and it is based here in Memphis, Tennessee. And it came about as a result of the fact that on the internet, it is really sort of the Wild West. Jeff Janowitz and I speak openly about that also in the first episode of this podcast. And it's really quite interesting to put this into perspective of just how Wild West it really is, because the FCC does not control what Radio Memphis does. I mentioned that earlier in this podcast, but here's the thing. There's this whole thing about the death of FM radio. And I mention that because FM and AM radio, well, they're up against the ropes. Now, they've had a pretty good run of it. We're talking about 100 years of good, solid broadcasting, at least, through traditional means. And there are folks out there, And I speak of the younger generation that still have issues trying to understand why that is, why AM radio exists at all, aside from just talk, even though in some aspects they are playing around with some music. A lot of the talkers are moving over to FM, and they're getting away from music because music has now moved on to the internet through streaming operations like Radio Memphis, or through the ability to download all of these tunes and put them in your playlist and listen to them at will. That's kind of a fun thing, you know, to consider when you look at the big picture of things and how AM and FM companies are still trying to hold on to that. And one of the other questions that I'm asked quite a bit is why is it that FM radio sucks so bad? And I'll tell you why. And I've witnessed this. This was toward the end of my FM career. There were serious meetings being held, and these eggheads I use that term loosely, these people who thought they knew what was about, you know, what broadcasting was about, thought of the compact disc as being the only real viable threat to FM radio. I could see that. Personality-driven radio is a fairly rare thing, and it's even becoming more rare because companies out there, broadcast companies, don't want to pay their jocks anymore. They're not necessarily hiring so much, and I'm not going to beat this horse any further than I am, but or I have been. But you've got to keep in mind that with the internet, personality-driven stations like Radio Memphis are actually gaining so much ground on traditional AM and FM or terrestrial stations that it is changing attitudes, and it's changing the way people think about consuming their entertainment. Much like we heard back in the 60s with the pirates that were hanging out in the North Atlantic, we're doing the same thing, but right in within our own shores, and actually globally too. There's tons of these radio stations, these internet stations all over the world, and you're hearing they're hearing the music that is not necessarily deemed popular or playable by these terrestrial stations. Therefore, the pirates have picked it up and they're putting it out on the web for people to consume. The beautiful thing about that is what was considered an illegal act of broadcasting, which I guess it technically still is being abandoned by the pirates themselves by moving everything online. Radio Caroline is a prime example. Radio Caroline had been around for a long, long time, and it had its ups and downs. And I believe it was about 1966, 67, the BBC had somehow got some legislation through Parliament in Great Britain to make that thing such an illegal activity that these ships could be boarded and these people be thrown into jail, even outside of the international borders, which is where these pirates were operating at the time. They hung it on a very, very weird and, I guess, a dark kind of law, but apparently one of these broadcasters had somehow interfered with ship-to-shore communications during an emergency, and as a result, they used that law and that incident to create other laws and making those pirates, actionable consequences to what they were providing for their listeners when they were wildly popular at the time. Well, now when all that happened, Radio Caroline then tried to go legit and get their own station. Well, by this time the BBC had started to lighten up a little bit on their regulations and allowed Radio Caroline to carry a traditional signal. Now, granted, they were given something in the shortwave band, which you had to have a different type of radio, but that meant that they could broadcast in a much wider area, not just across England, but into Europe and technically around the world. Now, Radio Caroline broadcasts where? On the internet. It's amazing how we've kind of gone full circle that way. Well, and with that, I want to include a little bit of audio, a little history. Since we've been discussing some radio history, I want to include a little bit of radio history from Radio Memphis. Now, I haven't mentioned anything from Clear Channel, well, from where I used to be when I was at Rock 103 working with Bad Dog, because I'm saving up a lot of that stuff to play back for you at a time when I'm going to devote an entire episode of this podcast to working with the great Bad Dog McCormack, but that's neither here nor there. So, at any rate, check this out. When we started our operations, let's see here, it was in the 1st of July of 2011. Yeah, that's our anniversary. Technically, it's the 1st of July. We tend to celebrate around the 4th of July because it just works out that way. It's a natural holiday. We usually have some type of a party that's happening. But on the 1st of July of 2011, we went on the air, and sadly, the recording of that incident never survived. I don't know what happened to it. I own the damn station, and I still don't know what happened to it. But it was practically, it was practically disastrous, especially considering that by July, that I believe it was the 24th, when we put our first human voice on it, it was a complete disaster. There were some 20 people in this room. There were cameras. I know it exists somewhere on video. I got to track all that down. But at any rate, it happened, and it's like any other type of broadcast. The first time out is always going to be a rough one, but we were able to pull it off. And here we are, you know, in 2014, just a rocking and rolling. And we reached our furthest distance geographically. Through, of course, the internet is boundless. I mean, you could technically have people listening to us at the International Space Station since they have an internet connection up there. But we were able to have an interesting conversation on a continent very, very far away on a telephone. But here's the thing. That wasn't your standard telephone system. We hooked it up through Google Voice to make this work. Here's a little snippet of our interview with Alex Eilers, who was down in Antarctica and talking to Radio Memphis. How are you, Alex?
I'm good. How are you?
We're fine, thank you. We're live on the air. You called it a great time.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, I called a little early, too. I'm thinking...
Well, we were just sitting there talking about you, and we got your pictures, and you don't look too terribly cold where you were standing there.
Oh, my God, it's fucking freezing here. -7 today.
You can say the real word on this radio station.
Yeah, you can say whatever you want to here. You're free to talk dirty if you want to.
Very cold.
Yeah, I hear you. So, you see, that's kind of all of it in a nutshell. This is the excitement that I get while discussing the industry that I'm in. Now, from Radio Land, the podcast, what to expect down the way? Well, I'm working feverishly on getting a couple of radio legends to come be a guest on here. We've spoken about it off and on, about putting something together in a public venue and inviting some folks to come in and sit down and take part in this actual podcast. It will treat it like a recorded radio show, of course, and we'll have some real fun with a chance for you to step up to an open mic and actually ask all of us some questions. We're working on something that's if we can get it put together with a great old friend of mine, if we can make this thing happen, we will certainly tell you about it, and we'll tell you how you can get involved and where it will be and all that other stuff. But it's still in the planning stages, so you know, hang tight. It's all coming soon. Here's what's coming up on the next edition from Radioland.
Brian McMurray is his name, and he's the father of Roger.
Hello, Radioland. That jagged, toothy grin that he's got.
Oh, yeah.
Also has a tie to your art form.
There's no telling what kind of sound would come out of his face if that was...
No, it's a Swedish porn track. Is what it
is. Yeah. Yeah, we're trying to get back over there. I think we're going to be over there this summer ourselves. So.
Fantastic.
So we may cross paths at some point. I don't think you'll be able to escape out of Germany, pardon the pun, but...
They're not watching that close anymore.
not anymore.
Amazeballs. Okay.
I get a lot of email with that in there now. Amazeballs.
I bet so.
Radio Memphis is an internet broadcasting service provided by PirateRadioStudios.com, Memphis, Tennessee, USA.
Before we wrap up this edition of the podcast from Radioland, first of all, thank you so very much for taking the time to listen. Appreciate you being a part of this thing. We ask that you tell a friend about it. And as we grow this thing, we are now available on TuneIn. The TuneIn app, it's a pretty cool place. It's a kind of a collection of internet radio stations, of course, but there's also quite a collection of podcasts, and we are now available up there. So we got more and more people that are tuning in on that, and we're also working to get our stuff put together on Stitcher, which is also another great deal too. Of course, we're always available up on iTunes, and you can find it at my blog, rickchetter.blogspot.com. It's RICCHETTER.blogspot.com. You can also find us at the home of where this podcast is hosted, which is over at Podbean. Very simple, rickcheddar.podbean.com. Your comments are always welcome. If you'd like to get into it, somebody will read them and let us know, let us know what's going on. So before we wrap this up, I do need to do the take care of actual little bit of business, because all of this audio that you've heard and this podcast, I do need to give credit to. Because that stuff has been collected, and I'll tell you where you can find it and learn more about it. Titanic, that audio there, compiled together by David Ring. The wireless telegraphist was Jack Phillips. Now, what you heard was not the original Jack Phillips. He is long since passed. In fact, he died as he saw rescue ships coming to get him, the sinking of the Titanic. We don't know who the telegrapher is, but David Ring is the man who put it all together. You can find more on that on YouTube, as you can find most of these snippets of audio. The broadcast from Herb Morris and the recording of the Hindenburg tragedy from courtesy of WLS Chicago, May 6, 1937. Edward R. Murrow standing in the bombing of London is courtesy of YouTube as well, August 24th, 1940. It was uploaded sometime, obviously, since then, because I don't think YouTube was around in the 40s, although I kind of wish it was, because can you imagine what kind of fun stuff they would have put up there? The fantastic broadcast from Pearl Harbor, the phone connection to NBC, that occurred not far from the KTU Tower in Honolulu, Hawaii, on December 7, 1941. That is courtesy of the Michigan State University G. Robert Vinson Voice Library. More information can be found online there. I'll post more on the links and where you can find some of this stuff on the podcast page. Actually, it's my blogger page. You'll find more about it there at blogspot.com. That was the live telephone call broadcast on NBC. Dewey Phillips, Red Hot and Blue from 1952 while in the hospital, also courtesy of YouTube, as was the snippet from WJW. I'm glad I never worked for that station in Cleveland. WJW in Cleveland, 1957. Alan Freed, the Moondogs. Radio Caroline, that comes to us from nostalgiastore.co.uk. That's the Radio Caroline and Radio London imaging pieces from the 1960s, nostalgiastore.co.uk. You can buy their CDs and you can hear more on the fantastic history of the pirate radio broadcasters out of the North Atlantic at nostalgiastore.co.uk. And finally, Alex from Antarctica. That is courtesy, of course, from our friends at Radio Memphis. I say that as though they are my friends. Ah, they are. They're family, too. But I work there, but I got to give credit where credit is due. So there you go. There's a look at where all of that audio came from this edition of From Radio Land. We certainly hope you've enjoyed tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Thanks again. And remember, tell a friend where you found it. Like I said, iTunes, soon on Stitcher, certainly up on TuneIn, and of course at the blog and on Podbean as well. We're out there. Subscribe. The RSS feed is up and running, awaiting your subscription if you choose to do it that way. Until next time, thanks for tuning in, and I'm Rick Cheddar from Radioland.